60 Books, presented by Store Consulting and Coaching. Two athletes. The first is on national television at the age of 2, putting a golf ball, and by 4 he is in serious training. The second is a boy in Switzerland whose mother coaches tennis and who refuses to coach him. He plays badminton, basketball, skiing, wrestling, swimming, skateboarding. He does not commit to tennis until he is well into his teens, and his coaches complain that he will not take it seriously. Today, Range by David Epstein. In two sentences, in most fields that matter, the early specialist loses to the person who sampled widely first, because breadth is what lets you recognize a problem you have never seen before. The head start is real, and it is temporary. From the Reading Room, this is 60 Books. I'm Miles. 60 of the best management books of the last 100 years, one per episode, read for leaders and teams who think differently, and for work where AI is now part of the job. Nora, this book is a direct answer to the one we did 3 episodes ago.
It is written as a rebuttal to the 10,000-hour story, and it opens by putting the two athletes side by side on purpose.
Say who they are.
Tiger Woods and Roger Federer. And Epstein's point is not that Tiger's path is wrong. It is that we tell the Tiger story constantly and the Federer story almost never, even though Federer's is far more typical of elite performers, including in sport.
What does the research on athletes actually show?
That elite athletes in most sports have what researchers call a sampling period. They play several sports, they specialize later than their less successful peers, and the delay does not cost them. In some studies, it appears to help.
So why does the Tiger story dominate?
Because it is a better story. It has a beginning. Early specialization is legible, and it gives parents something to do on a Tuesday.
All right, what is the actual mechanism? Because so far this is a vibe.
The mechanism is the best idea in the book, and Epstein takes it from the psychologist Robin Hogarth. Learning environments come in two kinds, kind ones and wicked ones.
Define them.
A kind environment has stable rules, repeating patterns, and fast, accurate feedback. Chess, golf, firefighting in a familiar building type. You do the thing, you find out immediately whether it worked, and the world does not change its mind about the rules.
And a wicked one.
Rules are unclear or change. Patterns do not repeat exactly. Feedback is delayed, partial, or actively misleading. Most of business, most of medicine outside of narrow procedures, most of leadership, and essentially all of strategy.
And this is where the 10,000 hours claim breaks.
Precisely, and it is not a rhetorical break, it is a mathematical one. We cited the McNamara meta-analysis in episode 4. Deliberate practice explained 26% of the variance in games, 21% in music, 18% in sports, 4% in education, and less than 1% in the professions.
The number falls as the environment gets wickeder.
That is the whole book in one line. Practice pays where the pattern repeats. Where it does not, the accumulated pattern becomes a liability because you will confidently apply it to a situation that only resembles the one you learned.
The author,
David Epstein. He was an 800-meter runner at Columbia, where he also did a master's in environmental science and journalism, and he has said that a fellow runner's death from a heart condition is part of what pushed him into science reporting.
And the career.
Senior writer at Sports Illustrated, then investigative reporting at ProPublica. His first book was The Sports Gene in 2013, about the biology of athletic performance, and that is where he first collided with the deliberate practice literature and with Anders Ericsson.
They argued in public.
They did, respectfully and repeatedly. Ericsson's objection to Range was that Epstein was attacking a caricature, since Ericsson never claimed 10,000 hours was a threshold. That number was Gladwell's summary. So the fight is partly two people defending themselves against a third person's headline.
Range came out.
2019. And it became the standard counterweight on the executive shelf, which is why you will hear a chief executive quote both books in the same conversation without noticing they contradict each other.
Take me through the rest of the argument.
Start with match quality. That is a term from economics for the fit between the work and the person doing it. Epstein's argument is that the sampling period is not wasted time, it is how you discover match quality, and that switching is usually a sign of information rather than a failure of grit.
There is an economic study behind it.
comparing systems that force students to specialize early against ones that let them sample. Early specializers get a head start in earnings. The late specializers close the gap, and they are less likely to leave the field entirely because they picked something that actually fit.
And the neurodivergent read on match quality.
This is the most useful frame in the episode, and I want to be careful with it. Autistic adults face high rates of unemployment and underemployment, and the standard story about Apache Resume is that the person could not hold a job. Match quality reframes the same history as a search. Several attempts, each producing information, until the fit is right.
That could sound like a comfortable excuse.
It could, and I am not offering it as one. The distinction is whether anything was learned. A search produces increasingly specific knowledge about the conditions under which you do your best work. Sensory environment, meeting load, autonomy over sequence. Someone who can articulate that after four jobs has done real work. Someone who cannot has had four jobs.
Next idea.
Analogical thinking, which is Epstein's proposed replacement for narrow expertise. He uses Kepler, who worked out planetary motion largely by reasoning from magnets, boats, and light, because nobody had the right concepts yet, so he borrowed from wherever he could.
And there is a study of scientists.
Kevin Dunbar sat in on molecular biology labs and recorded how discoveries actually happened. When experiments produced results nobody expected, the labs that got somewhere used analogies from other fields, and they were usually working in groups with mixed backgrounds. The labs where everyone had the same training got stuck.
The outsider theme.
Which recurs. He discusses problem-solving platforms where hard technical problems that stumped specialists were posted publicly and were disproportionately solved by people from adjacent fields, not the field itself. The specialists had exhausted the moves their training suggested.
Now do the neurodivergent version of that, because I think it is more complicated than the book allows.
It is, and this is the tension worth naming. On the surface, range and monotropism are opposites. Monotropism, from Dinah Murray and colleagues, describes attention pooling deeply into a small number of interests. That reads as early specialization, which the book is arguing against.
So does this book indict the autistic mind?
No, and here is why. Deep interests in practice are frequently serial. 2 years of intense focus on one thing, then another, with real depth in each. That is not narrow specialization. That is sampling, conducted at a depth most people never reach in anything.
A portfolio of deep interests, rather than a survey of shallow ones.
And that is arguably the most valuable version of range there is, because analogical thinking requires that you actually know the source domain. You cannot reason from magnets to planets if your knowledge of magnets is a headline. The person with four genuinely deep unrelated interests is the ideal case for Epstein's argument, and the book never describes them.
What about the ADHD side?
The interest-driven attention pattern produces breadth almost involuntarily, and wicked environments reward noticing the thing that does not fit. The cost is the well-documented difficulty in kind environments, the repetitive, procedurally stable work where practice is exactly what pays. So the coaching question is not how do I make this person more consistent? It is which environment is this person in, and can it be changed?
Two more ideas before I push back on one.
Late bloomers and the question of when a career is allowed to start. Epstein spends real time on people whose working lives began properly in middle age. Van Gogh, who failed as an art dealer, a teacher, and a preacher before he painted seriously, and who was dead about a decade later. And Frances Hesselbein, who had no formal career until she volunteered with the Girl Scouts in her small Pennsylvania town, and eventually ran the whole organization and received the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
And the neurodivergent version of that is not subtle.
A great many adults are diagnosed in their 30s, 40s, or 50s, often after a child is assessed. The years before that are frequently described, by the person themselves, as wasted. What that history usually contains is uninterpreted effort. The same work, done without knowing what the difficulty was, and therefore without any way to arrange conditions around it.
So a late start is not the same as a late beginning.
The clock everyone measures against, be established by 30, is a convention, and Epstein's contribution is showing how many exceptional records break it. For someone who spent two decades not knowing why the ordinary route was so expensive, that is not consolation. It is accurate.
The other idea.
Lateral thinking with withered technology, which comes from Gunpei Yokoi at Nintendo. He built the Game Boy out of components that were already cheap, old, and thoroughly understood, while competitors chased better screens. It had a monochrome display, and it outsold everything, because reliability and battery life were what actually mattered.
The general principle being,
deep knowledge of an unfashionable thing, applied in a new place, beats shallow knowledge of the fashionable thing. Which is a good description of what a serial deep interest is worth on a team, and a good argument against hiring exclusively for current relevance.
There is one chapter I want to push back on before the critique.
Drop your familiar tools.
Go.
Epstein borrows from the organizational theorist Carl Weick, writing about wildland firefighters who died while still carrying their heavy equipment, unable to drop the tools that defined them as firefighters, even when dropping them would have let them outrun the fire. It becomes a metaphor for expertise that will not let go of its methods.
And my objection
is the right one. For a lot of neurodivergent professionals, the familiar tools are not ego, they are load-bearing. The routine, the checklist, the specific sequence, the same software, the same desk. Telling that person to drop their familiar tools is not liberating advice, it is a description of the conditions under which their performance collapses.
So how do you hold both?
By separating the tool from the conclusion. Weick's firefighters were not killed by having equipment, they were killed by an identity that could not survive setting it down. The rule worth keeping is, hold your conclusions loosely and your scaffolding tightly. Those are different things, and this book blurs them.
And there is a chapter about disaster that I want in before we turn.
The Challenger launch, which Epstein uses to make a point about what counts as evidence. Engineers had a real concern about the O-rings in cold weather, and the concern was substantially qualitative. Pattern, unease, experience. The culture around the decision required quantitative proof, and since the data was ambiguous, the objection did not survive the meeting.
Say why that belongs in this show.
Because the same rule governs who gets to raise a concern in an ordinary organization. If the only admissible form of objection is a clean number, then the person who has noticed a pattern but cannot yet formalize it stays quiet or gets dismissed. That falls hardest on people who process differently and arrive at the conclusion before the articulation.
And that connects backward.
To Collins in episode 1, on confronting the brutal facts and building mechanisms so information cannot be ignored. And to Marquet in episode 5, whose whole intervention was making it structurally normal to say the unwelcome thing.
What has not held up?
The method first, and it is the same charge we made against Collins and against Gladwell. Epstein selects on the outcome. He finds successful generalists and identifies breadth as the cause. Nobody counts the people who sampled widely, developed range, and never landed anywhere. There are a great many of them, and they do not get chapters.
Erickson's objection.
That the book argues against a claim he did not make, and that his own research always emphasized the structure and quality of practice rather than a raw hour count. There is something to that.
And the evidence for the central prescription.
Weaker than the prose suggests. The sampling period findings are largely correlational and drawn from sport, where the outcome is unusually measurable. Extending them to careers is a reasonable inference, not a demonstrated result. And the actionable version, sample more, is very hard to convert into a decision on a Tuesday morning when you have rent.
The tier.
Popular science journalism of a high standard, with one genuinely durable idea inside it. If you remember nothing else from the book, remember kind and wicked environments, because that distinction is real, useful, and tells you when the other book on your shelf applies.
The recap in this show's frame. Range says breadth beats early depth wherever the rules keep changing. For a neurodivergent leader, or one leading neurodivergent people, the operating instructions are these. Ask first whether the environment is kind or wicked, because that determines whether practice or breadth is what pays, and it tells you which of your people you have placed badly. Apache history may be a search rather than a failure, and the test is whether it produced knowledge about fit. Serial deep interests are range in its strongest form, not the opposite of it. And when someone tells you to drop your familiar tools, check whether they mean your conclusions or your scaffolding, because only one of those is safe to put down. And AI.
This book gives us the sharpest frame yet for where these tools help, because Hogarth's distinction maps almost exactly onto what they are good at.
Explain.
These systems are trained on enormous quantities of past pattern. That makes them formidable in kind environments, where the rules are stable and the pattern repeats, and much less trustworthy in wicked ones, where the situation only resembles what came before, which is precisely where they sound most confident.
So the practical rule.
Use them heavily where feedback is fast and the answer is checkable. Use them as a first draft and not a conclusion where it is not. That is Collins's technology rule from episode 1, restated. It accelerates whatever you already have, including your errors.
And the genuine upside for our audience.
Analogical thinking on demand. What field has already solved a problem shaped like mine is a question these tools answer well, and it lowers the cost of the thing Dunbar found in those labs. And for the person with serial deep interests, it is a fast way to test whether the analogy between two of your domains actually holds, rather than being a pattern you like.
The cautions.
2. Homogenization. If everyone reaches for the same tool, the range in a room drops and you get consensus faster than you get insight. And the usual one. The evidence that AI support improves outcomes for neurodivergent workers is early and mostly practitioner reports. Promising practice, not established fact.
Nora, thank you.
My pleasure.
That is Range. Next time on 60 Books, Hidden Potential by Adam Grant and the uncomfortable question of who gets identified as promising in the first place. I'm Miles. See you then.